Hi, everybody. My name is Ann Gilmer, and I'm M's wife. I used to tell you that I was Ann and hoped you wouldn't find out that I was M's wife. But thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous and to Al-Anon, I don't have to feel like that today. I would like to thank the committee for inviting us. It's truly been a wonderful weekend. The mountains are so pretty, and the peace, it's been a special peace here for me. It's been interesting watching him in the fire, in the fireplace. I think he's afraid it might go out, and every time I look, he's putting logs on it. And that's been an interesting thing, even at 3 o'clock this morning. But it truly has been a wonderful experience being here in the mountains. I grew up in Salem, and what I share with you today is the results of many fourth step inventories. I didn't realize that I grew up in a home that had alcoholism in it. We didn't know that this uncle was an alcoholic. We just thought he was nuts. He was a railroad man. He worked on the dining car during the era of the Powhatan era. And when he would come off the road, he'd always be a little rambunctious, especially when he got home. And I remember being a little girl laying in my bed. We all lived there in a big two-story family home. My grandparents had this big house, and they were kind of enablers. They wanted their children, which they only had two that lived, and they were very protective of these two children, so they always wanted those children right under them. So we all lived in that big house together, and everybody went crazy at the same time. But when this uncle would come home in the middle of the night, I would lay in my bed, and I would hear him say, "Catch the bed, Helen, here it comes." And he'd hit the floor, bop. And she'd say, "Get up and get in the bed." And he'd say, "I'm trying, here it comes again, get it." And this would go on for hours. And I, even as a child, I'd lay there and think, "I wish she'd hurry up and help him catch that bed." This went on for many years, and it wasn't a normal household there. My parents were quite young, and I was 8 years old when the next child was born, and then we had two children right close together. And each time another child came into the family, I was pushed a little further back, and they didn't have time for me anymore. I was very protected. They didn't want me to go out of the yard and play with other children. They had a fear, and the old man did, my grandfather. So I was very an introvert at an early age, very insecure. And I went to school, and I didn't fit because I was the youngest kid in the class. All the other kids were older, all the way through my whole schooling. I realize now that I was always the youngest kid on the block. When I got to high school, I ventured out a little bit more, and I met a young man, and we dated. But he was young, and the same age I was, and so another young man came into my life who was older, and he had a job. He'd been in service, and we began to date, and we decided to get married. And we said, "I do," and then we didn't. He couldn't stand me, and I didn't like him at all. But we tried to make a go of it. And what I realize now is that young man had a drinking problem. And the more responsibilities he had, the more he drank. He had a good job. He worked at the VA Medical Center there in Salem. He had a car. But he was a wandering drunk. He would get paid and wander off, and you might not see him for a week, and when you think he's gone for good, he'd wander back. And I often laugh about West Virginia, because one time he wandered away, and when he came back after about a week, I said, "Where have you been?" And he said, "He'd been to Jenkins Jones, West Virginia," and I hit him. Because I didn't know it was a place called Jenkins Jones, West Virginia. But I became a fighter, and I'm not proud of what I share with you today, neither am I ashamed of it. If it took that to get me where I am in my spiritual growth, I'm grateful. But I became a fighter at an early age because I didn't know how to control my anger. I didn't know how to handle the fear that would set in because I had these small children, and I didn't know what to do when I didn't have enough money, and I didn't know how to handle situations that would come up, and I didn't know where he was. So I became a fighter, and I wasn't as large as I am now. And you know, believe it or not, I've been in some places and turned them out where the police were scared to go into. And it didn't faze me one bit. I remember one time I got so upset and angry because he left me with no money. The car had broke down. The kids needed some things, and I found out that he was at a bootleg joint. We didn't have state stores and bars. Back then, you had bootleggers. And I went into that place. I knocked on the door, and when the lady opened it, I just pushed right in. And there was a whole bunch of men and women sitting around the table drinking, had a couple of fifths of bourbon and beer cans, and I just knocked it all on the floor. And they were scrambling, trying to get to me so I wouldn't waste it. And I hauled off, and I just hit them upside the head and knocked them down. Because I had an advantage. They were drunk. And I just beat up everybody in there. And I went home, and I thought, what have I done? I was just horrified that I could get into something like that. The next day, my mom saw me, and she said, what have you been into? And I said, what are you talking about? And someone had told her what I had done. And the lady said, you know, they should send Ann to Korea. She could get rid of that war in 24 hours. And I was ashamed of that. And I began to try to find answers, and I was always searching. And I would go to church, and things didn't work out. And finally I thought, well, maybe if we had a decent home. We were living in a little three-room house, and the kids were coming rapidly. So I thought, well, maybe if we had a house with a yard and lived like normal people, things would get better. So I struck out, and I made friends with a realtor. And he and I got our heads together, and we built a whole subdivision. And it was 14 houses in that subdivision, and we were the first family to move in. And I thought, now we'll live happily ever after. Needless to say, that was the worst mistake I ever made, because the whole subdivision was drunk. All the men drank, and all the women worked two jobs. And I thought, you know, this is a disaster. I can't live like this. And I remember he got in jail for being drunk. A bunch of men was, you know, they were the stupidest bunch of men I ever seen in my life. They sit on the side of the road in a car and drink. So the police took them all to jail. And one of the wives called and said, I just wanted you to know that your husband has been picked up with the rest of the men, and they're all in jail. I said, good, at least I know where he is tonight. And went on back to sleep. But this was the story of my life for many years, and finally my parents stepped in, and they gave me the opportunity to try to get my life in some order. They took the kids, and they gave me a year to get my life in order. And I promised God, if you get me out of that mess, I'll never marry again. Well, I just went to work in Washington, D.C., and my parents took the kids, and I would come home on my days off. We missed each other terribly, because the kids and I always had a good rapport, and we kind of understood each other. I guess I grew up with them. And after about 10 months, the lawyer told me that he could get my divorce on constructive desertion. And I applied and went before the judge, and I got my divorce. And it wasn't too long after that that I met my present husband. And I didn't like him when I first met him because he drank. But he was completely opposite of the first husband. This husband was a homebody. He was in and out. He never stayed away from home a long time. He liked kids, and kids liked him. He was like the Pied Piper. He was the sandlot coach, and all the kids in the neighborhood, including mine, wanted to be on his team because he always had winning teams. So we decided after dating about 7 or 8 months that we would talk about getting married. And I didn't know how the kids would take this, but the kids and I sat down and talked about it. And if one of those children had said that they didn't like him, I wouldn't have married him. But all of them said, yeah, you know, we can make a go of this, and we can have our own home. And they were making all these big plans before I was. So we married him. And I wish I could stand here and tell you that we lived happily ever after. But that only lasted about 3 weeks. And I found out that this man could put away some booze. And I mean, he was a happy-go-lucky, good-time guy. And he made you think that he had a lot of money, and he didn't have a corn. And this was very frightening for me, because I thought, what have I gotten myself into? Because he wanted to party all the time. If he did something good, he would have to celebrate. And we had some heck of a celebrations at our house. I don't know about your homes, but we always had big celebrations at holiday time. And we had a lot of holidays that wasn't on the calendar. One time I saw him tying this big drunk over the obituary column. Oh, he just went all to pieces and had to have a drink because he was just over the obituary column. I thought, oh my goodness, somebody close to us must have passed away. And I got the paper, and when the soul in there, he knew. And this was to be the story of our life for about 8 long, heartbreaking years. The police was friends of his. They would bring him home. And I remember one time he came out of Roanoke over into Salem, and the Roanoke police, they didn't have any jurisdiction at that time, and they radioed for the Salem police, and they put him in the car and they brought him home. And I said, no, you're not going to bring him in here. I said, because he's drunk and he will keep us awake all night. And they said, yeah, but Miss Gilmer, if we carry him to jail, he keeps the prisoners awake all night. I said, better them than us. And he's standing there between us saying, I wish y'all would hurry up and make up your mind what you're going to do with me. I'm sleepy. Needless to say, they pushed him in the door and jumped in the car and ran off. But this was the story of our life for many years, and we didn't know what to do. I would read. I was always reading, but now I know I was reading the wrong stuff. I read one time, and I think I was going through the line at the grocery store, and you know how they have those interesting captions on the tabloids, and they said, do you have a drinking problem in your home? I thought, that's it. That's what I'm supposed to buy. So I bought this paper, and it said, order this little vial of medicine and put it in his highball, and he'll get sick and won't want to drink anymore. Well, that makes sense if you don't know anything about alcoholism. So I stole $10 out of his pocket. I wasn't about to cure him with my money. And I ordered that little vial of medicine, and it came. And he was getting ready to go to his sandlot banquet. Now, they had an excellent program, recreation program during that time. It was a group of men that coached, and they had a little athletic club, and the Baltimore Colts were their sponsors, and they would always send a Baltimore Colts football player in to speak, and they had great doings. So this particular night, he was getting ready to go to this banquet, and so I pulled out the little vial of medicine, and I said, would you like for me to fix you a highball while you're shaving? He said, sure. So I ran in there right quick and fixed that highball and pulled that little vial of medicine out, and it said, put from 2 to 3 drops. And I thought, 3 drops of anything wouldn't help that big dude. So I put 8. And I stirred that stuff up, and I carried it in there and watched him drink it. He drank it down and he finished in the bathroom and dressed and he said, "See you later." I said, "Okay." And about 20 minutes later, he came in and he was so violently sick, and I wasn't about to call no rescue squad or nothing. And we were up and down all night long. Then I had to pray again, "Lord, please don't let him die. I promise I won't try to cure him again if he lives." Next morning, we both had to call in on our jobs. And about 11 o'clock, he was able to hold a little Coca-Cola down over some crushed ice. And he said, "Man, I was so sick last night." I said, "I know it. What happened?" He said, "I don't know, but I'll never eat no more potato salad again as long as I live." I'd been in Al-Anon 4 years before he found out that he could eat potato salad okay. And things got worse. And I just didn't know what to do. I remember someone told me one time to pray and to light a candle in the home. It would bring peace. I almost burnt that house down. I had candles all over the place. And that didn't help. So I thought, we were living in a two-family house. The lady and her sister that owned the house, they lived upstairs and we lived downstairs. And I thought, well, maybe if we had a house with a yard and a dog and live like normal people, things would get better. So I struck out to build another house. All I did then was marry drunks and build houses. So we got this house, and you know, this was supposed to be one of the happiest times of our life. The kids were excited. They were in junior high school, and everybody was going to have their own room, and we had a basement where we were going to fix a rec room, and it was just going to be a lovely time of our life. But it didn't turn out that way, because while we were trying to hang curtains and drapes and fix the house upstairs, him and his drinking buddies was downstairs building an 8-foot bar. And corn liquor and bourbon and beer and pretzels and all kinds of good stuff was going on. And they were going to build this rec room down there, and there was blowtorches and electric saws, and I really didn't know if that house would stand. But things got worse after we moved into that house. By then, the kids were up in high school, and I was beginning to get very frightened. And I had run out of things and places to go, because no one seemed to understand, because, you know, they weren't seeing what I was seeing. They weren't seeing the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde syndrome. And I was always afraid when things got real bad to call the police, because I was afraid they'd take me, because by the time they got there, he'd be out of this thing he was in, and he'd be looking pretty normal, and I was the one that was a raving maniac. One of the frightening things during this time, I think, was, and I didn't know anything about blackouts, but he came home one day and he said, "Pack your bag. We're going on a little trip with a friend of mine and his wife. We're going to Florida." And just for a second, I knew that I didn't belong in Florida. But he convinced me that he had the money and that we were going to Florida with Jack and his wife. So we packed, and that Tuesday morning we packed the car, and they all got ready, and we took off down 220. Well, we didn't get to 220. We got down on Brandon Road at a liquor store, and he got 3/5 of booze. He opened one, pulled a drink, and all the way down the road he was drinking. We stopped in Charleston, South Carolina, and had supper, and it was a beautiful place, and the whole city was just gorgeous. And then we went on into Georgia, down in near the Florida line, and he was constantly drinking. Well, the next morning when we got over into Florida, they had self-service liquor stores, and this is the first time we'd ever seen that. Well, he got a basket, and up one aisle and down the other, and they took credit cards. So I think he tried to buy the owner out. And then we went on into Daytona Beach. And, you know, it's kind of hard to miss Daytona Beach because the ocean is at the end of the road. We stayed there 5 days, and we came back, and we had a good time. I did. I had a nice time. We went to SeaWorld. We went to the alligator farm where the Seminole Indians wrestled alligators. We went touring. We went catfishing with some friends. And I just had a nice time, but I noticed he was a little strange, but I just put that on, you know, he's always strange. And we took pictures, and we did all the little neat things, you know. Well, when we got back to Salem, I had the film developed in about a week, and I was real excited, and I was showing, I said, do you remember this? And I'd show him pictures, you know, and he'd look at the picture like, well, where did that come from? You know, and I'd show him another picture, and he'd look at it real strange, you know. And I said, well, you act like you wasn't on that trip with me. And he just kind of shooed me off, you know. And, you know, we had been in the program about a year when he let me know that he never saw Florida. And he went in a blackout a few blocks from home when he took that drink. And he was driving. Each one of us was taking turns driving. And he never saw Florida. And to me, that was one of the most frightening things that I had ever experienced, because I know now that's how so many accidents happen and so many weird things go on out there that people just don't remember. But anyway, we came back off that trip and things didn't get any better. And Labor Day, 1970, a bunch of men were down in the basement and they were drinking, and they were going to get rid of a particular chaplain that worked at the VA hospital that interfered with people that drank. That was the man I was supposed to talk to. So the next day, I called this kind gentleman, and I went over and talked to him, and I didn't want to jeopardize M's job. So I asked him, I said, do you know M? He said, everybody knows M. Well, I didn't know how to take that. I said, but do you know when he drinks, he just doesn't act right? He said, but I can help you, but I can't help him. I said, well, there's not a thing wrong with me, sir. I said, if you get him straight, we'll all be just fine. And so he said, well, M is an alcoholic. And this was my first knowledge of alcoholism. Because, you see, I associated alcoholics with Skid Row, with people that didn't work, people that had drank up their families. And, you know, here's a man that worked two jobs. Here's a man that was chief steward of the union over close to 2,000 people, and I could not see the alcoholism at that time. Well, this kind gentleman gave me a pamphlet and a phone number, and he asked me to come back that following Sunday to my first Al-Anon meeting. Now, I didn't know what I was going into, and this wasn't my pattern to leave home a lot, because I stayed at home. I was very, very cautious of where I went because I didn't want to get into serious problems with him. So, and we'd drink up a lot of friends. I didn't have a lot of close friends. So I didn't know how this pattern of me leaving was going to work out, but I did venture out that Sunday afternoon. And this pamphlet that they gave me said, if you work these 12 steps in your life, things will get better. So I went home and I took all 12 steps at night. Stayed up all night long, took those 12 steps. And you know, he got worse. The only thing that I remember in my first couple of meetings was that I didn't cause it. I couldn't control it. I couldn't cure it, but I could be a contributor. And I was an enabler. You see, I paid all the bills. I bought his clothes. I made his phone calls when he was too sick to call. I did all, he didn't have an incentive to do better because I did everything for this man but breathe, trying to control the uncontrollable. So after a few meetings in Al-Anon, I quit this. I was afraid. I was afraid I'd lose my home. I was afraid that that things wouldn't go right. But I had to take that chance. So I told him when he brought that check home, that's your check. You have to be responsible for your own bills. And he didn't like that. But I had to stand my grounds. And you know, he hurt my feelings because after a couple of months, he paid the bills better than I did. he didn't like me going off like this at first. But he wouldn't say too much. And at that time, I didn't know he had a tail on me, somebody watching my every move. I talked to the lady who became my first sponsor. And I was so relieved because this was the first time someone actually heard what I was saying. All those other years, people would either show me pity or tell me to pray or tell me to leave. And that was no solution for me. But this lady that turned out to be my sponsor was one of the most beautiful people. And she guided me through the program. And I'll be always grateful to her. We didn't have a lot of meetings in the Roanoke Valley like we have now. But I tried to go to 3 Al-Anon meetings and 1 AA meeting every week. And I'll always be grateful to the people in Alcoholics Anonymous because if it hadn't been for them, I don't know where I would have gone because they helped me to understand and to stop showing fear. Now, what I share with you during this time, it wasn't all Al-Anon. Some of it was Ann. Because I would take the literature home and lay it around because I wanted him to get this message. And he wouldn't read it. He'd take it and throw it in the trash. And so I'd have to go back to another meeting, get some more literature, and lay it around. And we just played this game for a long time. And one morning, he was laying there with this bad hangover. And he looked bad, and he was just terrible. And I went to that bed, and I said, you know one thing, I'm sick of you. I said, I've been running to these meetings trying to learn how to live with you, and you're getting worse. I said, now the heck with you, AA, Al-Anon, the whole bit, I'm through. And he raised up off the pillow, and he said, ah, girl, you're not doing what that literature teaches you. He said, that literature tells me that I'm a sick man and you're supposed to treat me better than this. But we were able to laugh a little bit that morning, and that was when I convinced him to talk to these two men from AA. Well, this was planned because the two guys had been kind of telling me some things to do. And the little fella, Fred, that turned out to be his sponsor, he would see me at the AA meetings and he'd say, how's it doing, Ann? I said, terrible. He said, good. He said, don't you know the sicker he gets, the quicker we can get him? I said, in that case, I'll help you then. So I started buying it for him. And he did get sick. I laugh now because he said he's the only man in the Roanoke Valley where the bootleggers paid him to go somewhere else and drink because they didn't want to contend with me. You see, I would threaten the bootleggers. I'd say, now you sell him another drink and I'm coming down there and I'm going to throw a brick right through your window. And they lock up. And they'd hand him some money and say, Em, you go somewhere else and drink because I don't want Ann to throw no brick through my window. And, you know, we're piecing part of this together because we don't know exactly what happened. But I didn't know what happened until he'd been in AA for about a year. I often wondered, but I just didn't have guts enough to ask. But when I got home from work, he looked terrible. and the closet door was off the track, and the clothes was all messed up in the closet, and I thought, well, I wonder what happened. Well, after he'd been in AA about a year, he told what happened. When he went into DT's, he fell in the closet, and I had an old fake fur coat hanging up in there, and it hit him upside the head, and he thought it was a bear. And he fought that bear for about 4 or 5 hours. And when he came to, the dog was licking him in the face and whining and scared the poor old dog to death. And that's when he surrendered. And he told me to call him in. So they had told me to let him make that call. So I said, well, I can get the number for you, but you'll have to talk to him yourself. So that was the beginning of our experience of going to AA and Al-Anon at the same time. We became very close to the people in the Salem group on Saturday night. That was a favorite of ours because it was very close-knit and a lot of husbands and wives there. And we had a lot of help during that time. By then, the children were growing up, and I was calming down enough to work the steps in my life the best of my ability, and I was able to admit that I was powerless over alcohol. I was powerless over everything. I was even powerless over me, and my life was very unmanageable. Now, I couldn't accept that at first because I had kept things together as I thought. But it wasn't long before I realized that, no, this was not the way to have to live. And I had to admit that I had no power over anything. And then when I got to step two, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I resented that word sanity. Well, I wasn't insane. Everybody in my neighborhood acted like I did. But then I soon learned that this wasn't normal either. I noticed after me and him came into the program, the whole neighborhood changed. So I had to look at that step real good because I had to come to the program and I had to come to, and then I came to believe that there was a power greater than myself. And then when I got to step three and had to turn my life and will over to the care of God, it's very hard to turn your life and will over to something that you don't understand. And I didn't understand God. I went to church. And I prayed, and I stand here, and I'm grateful today that the sick prayers that I was sending up back then that God didn't answer. Because I was pretty sick, and some of them things I was saying wasn't very nice, because one of my favorites was when, especially when he'd acted up and gone off and thrown away a lot of money, and I'd pray, dear God, send him home so I can kill him. So I'm glad that, you know, that one wasn't answered. So I had to learn the God of my understanding. It wasn't my mother's God. It wasn't the preacher's God. It was my personal relationship with God. And I found that God through Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, people like you, because if it wasn't for people like you, I wouldn't be here. I could see God in you. I could see the gleam in your eye. I could see the peace and the serenity, and I knew that that was hope. So I learned early to find the God that I could relate to. Someone suggested the Sermon on the Mount by Emmett Fox, and I thought that was one of the most brilliant books I'd ever read, and it changed my concept about God. I always went to church. Out of 5 kids, I'm really the only one that ever went to church. And of course, that's not saying much because I didn't do much with it, but I went. I learned during this time that when the pupil is ready, the teacher appears. And it wasn't long after I'd been in Al-Anon that someone handed me a little book, and all they said was, I found this helpful. And then about a week later, M came home, and he was in a class at the VA, and he enjoyed this first class, and he said, I believe you'd like this class. So I attended that class, and it was the same people teaching that class that had been given this little book out. So I kept going. And you know, it always amazed me in that class, it was about 60 people, and out of 60 people, Emma and I were the only ones that heard something. So we continued to go, I continued to go to the classes, and in later years, Em joined me, and we became members of that church. And it tied in with AA and Al-Anon principles. They live by principles in this church, and it just reinforced my spiritual life. I have to have these principles in my life because I had to have something that I could turn my life and will over to. I just couldn't do it and leave it. And when I'm with people like you, it makes it easier. And during this time, I was having a real, real hard time turning things over to God and leaving it. And I remember an old timer said, "Anne, look like you have such a hard time letting go and letting God say, why don't you make your God box like I do and write down what's bothering you and put it in that God box? Now, that's God's business. You stay out of the box." So I went home, and I got the biggest box I could find, and I put everything in there. And I said, "Now, I want to see you fix this one, God." And you know, by the end of the week, God was taking care of mostly everything that I had put in that box. So I know that God works. I know He works through my God box, because during these trying times of the beginning of the early part of our recovery, I had to use that box and rely on it. You see, I had these girls, I had three girls and one son, and they were by then coming out of high school, going into college, and we were able to help them go to college. But I remember relying on that God box so intently. The oldest girl was in college in Greensboro, and she was in nursing. And she called home one day and she said, "I need $1,000 by Thursday," and this was on Tuesday. And I said, "Well, honey, there's no way we can send you $1,000 by Thursday." I said, "I tell you what, I'm going to put this in the God box and we're going to practice these principles and see what happens." And Em came through about that time and he said, "Well, you go out and work in principles and I'll go get another job and we'll see which one get that money first." So I put it in the God box and I released it. And that Thursday, Charlotte called and she was a little tearful. And I said, "What happened? Did they throw you out of school?" And she said, "No, they gave me $1,000 because I'm in nursing. And, you know, God works right on time." I said, "Well, maybe you better tell him this." So then Em got cocky, and he'd come in and say, "Can I put something in your God box?" I say, "No." I said, "No, don't mess up my box. You make your own." But things started to get better. I began to feel better. You see, when I got here, I had a pain around my heart that they never could find. I was going to doctors and getting tests done and all kinds of x-rays, and they never could find that pain. And it was real. You know, I would think I was having a heart attack. And after I'd been in Al-Anon a couple of months, it was a pamphlet during that time called Allies for Al-Anon, and it was one paragraph in that it got my attention, and it said, "When the spouse of an alcoholic first comes to Al-Anon, they have headaches because they can't figure things out, heart spasms because their heart is in their mouth from fear, nausea because they're fed up, backaches because they can't bear it, foot trouble because they can't stand it, bladder and kidney trouble because they can't let go." And I had all of these symptoms. And I realized after about 6 weeks of going to Al-Anon that I didn't have that pain anymore, and I was breathing much better, and that I didn't have to hurt anymore physically due to not knowing what to do. Em hadn't quite made it into the program, and my sponsor realized this, and she started telling me to start writing my fourth step. And I know now that she knew I needed this because it took me emotionally away from the alcoholic. And during this time, he went on into the program. But I start learning about me. I learned that I had problems long before I knew anything about the alcoholic. I was very insecure, full of fear. I had a lot of self-pity, a lot of self-righteousness. And I laugh about that because when I was going through all of this inventory and it said self-righteous, I thought, well, I'm not self-righteous. But then I had to laugh because I was very self-righteous because I went to church and he didn't. And then he, no matter how drunk he was, he would stagger in at night and get out on his knees and pray. And I would be in the bed reading and I'd say, you ought to be ashamed of yourself. So I had to look at this. The alcoholic has been my teacher. If it hadn't been for him, I don't know where I would have been in my spiritual life. But I have had to work hard on my spiritual life. Right now, I've worked the steps many times, and I'm always going back to step one. And taking the fourth and fifth step, that was a miracle because things started to change. The sixth and seventh step, I've done them quite often. And when I got to the step where I had to make amends and I had to make a list of all people that I had harmed, I put me first on that list because I had done a lot of harm to me due to ignorance. Then I put those beautiful children because they didn't deserve what they got. So I always have tried to make amends to them. And I had to put my parents because I know I carried them through a lot of problems that they didn't need. And they didn't know which one of us would kill the other one first. And this was a lot of headache and heartache for them. And the alcoholic, I try to just change my attitude and try to be kinder, stop calling them names and stop acting ugly. And it's been a learning process. And right now, today I am on the last three steps to continue to take personal inventory. And I try to write as much as I can of feelings, what's going on inside of me, because I don't want that stuff to ever pack up again. So I continually write when something comes up that I can't handle, I start writing. And usually this was taught to me from my sponsor way back, because I know she knew that if you start writing, you'll get your own answers. So I just continually write. The 11th step, sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God. And this is where I am now. I've been on this a very long time. Sometimes I do real well, and then other times I'm just not with it. But I found out that praying was talking to God and meditating was listening. And I thought, no wonder I was having a hard time. I was doing all the talking and I didn't have time to listen. So I've been learning to meditate and to just still my mind. And it's amazing how God comes through with answers, through thoughts. You know, this is what it's all about. And I remember reading in the book of Proverbs, as a man thinketh in his heart, so shall he be. So I create my world by my thoughts. And so I have to get still and let God work through me to let God tell me what my next move is and how I should do it. Now, I wish I could stand here and tell you that I do this perfect, but you know, M always tries to get in there, and I think he thinks he's God. And I'll be meditating and God be telling me something, and then M comes through and he's going to tell me something. And we kind of get off track there sometimes. But now we have a quiet time in the middle of the day. And it works. You know, I get answers of what I'm supposed to do and how I'm supposed to do it. And I guess he does too. I'm into something now, and I have to share this with you because this is where I am today. Me and God had a talk. I worked straight nights in a psychiatric hospital. And about 2 years ago, I was seeing something that I didn't like, and it was, I worked straight nights, and at night, a lot of the little patients would come up and talk to me, and they were older people. They were diagnosed as alcoholics and drug abusers. And they would bring them in, and they would look terrible. Some of them would go into DTs. They would get them on good food, vitamins, going to AA meetings, and boy, they would be the happiest little people you ever seen for 28 days. Then they didn't have anything to do with them. They would send them right back to where they came from. And I watched this with a little man that became very dear to me, and they had to send that man out of state because they didn't have a place that he could afford. Most of the places in our area are anywhere from $12,000 to $2,000 a month. And so I kept watching this, and so this lady that does our taxes, she and I were talking one day, and we started putting our thoughts together, and we wanted to build a home. We started out building a home for the elderly, and things started working and unfolding. Then the young says, "You're crazy. You really blew it this time. Girl, you can't do that." And I said, "Why?" And so I think he became fearful of what was going on. But we kept putting our thoughts together, and the church that I attend had 6 acres of land, and they let us have this 6 acres of land at a bargain. Everything went through pretty good. We even got some money, but we didn't get all we needed. Then things started to go down. And I thought about Peter walking the water, and you know, when he realized that he was walking, he started sinking. And I think that's what happened to me. You know, when this fear would set in, I'd lose my purpose. I'd lose my contact with God, and then things wouldn't go right. But M jumped in, and he saved us, and he started to helping us, and we got it back together again. And it was so ironic that 10 days ago, we found out that we can get the rest of the money that we need as long as it's for alcoholics and substance abusers. So we're on a good track again. We've got to do a lot of paperwork, but it's just been so interesting. And I know that I have to let go and let God. And the most wonderful thing about all of this is we've got a lot of the staff already to come in with us, and the majority of them are in the fellowship with us. So I can just see this beautiful thing unfolding. And if I can just stay out of it, if I can just not help God, you know, I think he can handle this by himself. But I always want to help. So I'm working on that real closely to not mess it up. I've had a hard time with acceptance. And I was at a meeting with him at an AA meeting last year. And I've read the big book many times, but you know, somewhere along the line, they sneak pages in there that I didn't see. And this page 449 on acceptance, it says, "Acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. When I am disturbed, it is because I find some person, place, thing, or situation, some fact of my life, unacceptable to me. And I can find no serenity until I accept that person, place, thing, or situation as being exactly the way it is supposed to be at this moment. Nothing, absolutely nothing, happens in God's world by mistake. Unless I accept life completely on life's terms, I cannot be happy. I need to concentrate not so much on what needs to be changed in the world, as on what needs to be changed in me and in my attitudes." And I tell you, that has really changed my life, because I have to accept. I can't be happy if I'm in there helping. And God doesn't need my help. He's doing a pretty good job. We were doing real well working these principles in our life, and in 1983 and 84, M had cancer, and the fear set in again. We didn't know whether he would talk again. It was he had a cancer on the larynx, and we didn't know what would come out of there. But it was a learning experience, because he went and talked to our minister, who was very, very up on AA principles, and he had to take an inventory and go through the 12 steps. And I never will forget, we were getting ready to go off on a trip like this, and the doctor called us at home, and he told him, "I don't know what you're doing, but keep doing it, because we can't find that cancer." Today he gets a little hoarse, but that's because he hollers at me. But so far he's had a clean bill of health, so we know that this program works. And it ties in with the 12th step, because the 12th step says after having a spiritual awakening is the result of these steps. We practice these principles in all of our affairs. And we've had to learn this. We've had to practice this in every area of our life. I want to share a little bit with you about those young people that turned out to be pretty good youngsters in spite of us. My oldest daughter is married and has two sons, and she lives in Greensboro, North Carolina, and she is a beautiful young lady, and she's a nurse. And she's just a joy to be around, and we just have such a good time together. And this was the young lady that said, "When I grow up, I'm never coming back." And I said, "Can I go with you?" And one night she called, after we'd been in the program for several years, she called, and in her way, she let us know that everything was okay, because she'd been doing private duty nursing with alcoholics. And the next young lady, Jerry's a wonderful young lady. She's just always, she can't do enough for us. She's always there. She lives in Greensboro, and she's married. And she's just a joy to be around. And we always have a good time when we always get together. Now, I wish I could stand here and tell you those other two are like that. My son, he's an ex-Marine, and I don't see too much of him anymore. And it's okay. He's a drunk. He was drunk before he went in the Marines. It just escalated after he went in the Marines. And that's been, I guess, 10 years ago. And I remember one day he got a job. He's lost many good jobs. He's lost his driver's permit one time for 5 years. And you would think if the person lost the permit for 5 years, you'd think they wouldn't drive and drink. But you know, after 5 years, he got that permit back, and 2 weeks later, he was driving and drinking. And it just amazes me how he lives. One day he had to ride to work with me because he couldn't get a ride, and I remember looking at him, and he looked bad, and he smelled bad, and he was just terrible. And I looked at him, and I said, "You know one thing, I know just enough people in this Roanoke Valley to have you committed," and I thought he was going to jump out the car. And since then, I've never seen him too much. It used to bother me. But I am not responsible for another human being. He knows where the help is. He's seen our lives change. And he's referred a lot of people to AA himself. But I don't know what another person's bottom is. And I just stuff him in the God box, and I'm going to let him go. Now, the young lady, my youngest daughter, she's a beautiful young lady. She's just a living doll now. She was on cocaine for 2 years, and we didn't even know it. She has a good job. She was going to get married, and her and the young man both were on cocaine, and they had to go through treatment. But you know, it was the best thing that ever happened, because that young lady changed. She always was different. You could be talking to her, and when she got to the place that she didn't want to hear you anymore, she just pulled her shade down. You didn't get through. But now she doesn't do that. We got so good to gather that she was transferred back in the area on her job, and she lived in an apartment across the street from us. We sold our home and moved into an apartment, and then we decided we better not do this, and then we built another house. And so this young lady, her name is Chris, and Chris went in with us, and we built a duplex, and it turned out real nice, and I really enjoyed it. She's not home very often, just maybe once a week, and she enjoys her part, and we don't even hear each other. We don't know whether anybody's home or not. And it's really been nice. She doesn't go to meetings like I'd like to see her go, but that's not my business. She knows where the answers are. And I have to go back and I have to remember my Al-Anon teachers. And one of my favorites is that if I am powerless over alcohol, my only reasonable course is to live and let live. To learn to live my own life fully and to let others live theirs. Or more simply put, mind your own business. Right now, today, I will lighten my burden by dropping that part of it which does not belong to me. Today, I will look more closely at my thoughts and impulses and take only such actions as is required of me. And the only requirement for me is to mind my own business. So that's what I'm doing. I don't get into other people's... I'd like to help them, but I can't even help my own self some days, so I just let go and let God. And that hasn't been easy. The slogans haven't been easy for me, to let go and let God. Easy does it. I want everything yesterday, and this is what, you know, I have a hard time with. But things are much better, and I have the tools to work with. I have people like you in my life. I have beautiful weekends like this that restore me to sanity. And I am ever grateful to each one of you for being here. Because like I say, if it wasn't for people like you, there would be no me. And I know this because I work in a psychiatric facility. Em and I have spoken in prisons. And I feel so fortunate to be a part of this fellowship. In closing, I would like to say to each of you, take time to think. It is the source of power. Take time to read. It is the foundation of wisdom. Take time to play. It is the secret of staying young. Take time to be quiet. It is the opportunity to seek God. Take time to be aware. It is the opportunity to help others. Take time to love and be loved. It is God's greatest gift. Take time to laugh. It is the music of the soul. Take time to be friendly. It is the road to happiness. Take time to dream. It is what the future is made of. Take time to pray. It is the greatest power on earth. For there is a time for everything. Thank you.